Morning, everybody. Please be seated. Okay. Our first consolidated cases are case number 51541 and 51972, Lopez versus Corral and Corral versus Lopez. And for the appellant, we have Mr. Velez.
Yes, Your Honor.
You ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
Thank you, Your Honor.
For the record, Your Honor, Clark Velez from Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck on behalf of Mr. Lopez and Anthony Lopez and Associates. I did reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
I also want to point out, I think Mr. Coulter and myself looked at the calendar, and I think on the second matter it indicates that we are representing Dr. Corral, and I don't think that's correct, so I just wanted to point that out. We represent...
That's already been corrected.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. To start out, Your Honors, good morning. I think this matter has been sufficiently briefed. I think it's the issues are not all that involved, but I think that there's a lot of briefing. I can go over what we've talked about in our briefs. If there's specific questions, I can answer those. I think the core of the case is simply this was a dispute over a conflict about money, how much money needed to be paid on an assignment. I think it was a simple matter that could have been handled with the declaratory relief action and making a determination of where the money should have gone.
Well, when I practiced personal injury, I did a lot of personal injury cases when I was in practice for 2 decades. The person would go to the chiropractor. The chiropractor would give a lien. The plaintiff would sign it. The chiropractor would sign it. They'd send it to the attorney. The attorney would sign it. Then when we settled, we paid. I don't understand the problem here. What's wrong with Mr. Lopez that they couldn't pay this chiropractor?
And I think, Your Honor, that's the key question, because I think in cases where he could, and I think the testimony was that he would do that, but in these cases where you're talking about, for example, one case that they discussed at trial, there was a settlement of $3,500 and a doctor lien of $3,900. Now, the case law indicates that Mr. Lopez has a right to take his fees out first. That doesn't sufficiently cover either Dr. Corral or any other medical treater that's involved in the case, and that was the point. I think that the declaratory relief action was brought after Mr. Lopez went to Dr. Corral, tried to negotiate this, tried to say, look, here's what we can do. Let's work something out. That didn't work. That was unacceptable. And Mr. Lopez kept the full amount of the monies in the trust account and then went to the court for a declaratory relief action, ostensibly on the stamp where he said he'd only keep 33 1/3%, but I believe that interpleader action is in essence a declaratory relief action. What you're acting there is to try to get the court to do something to stop the impending litigation.
Now, when went to court, did he deposit the money with the court clerk?
No, he kept it in the trust account.
Okay. So it wasn't an interpleader.
He didn't. But in essence, I think I've looked at federal cases off the top of my head, I can recall that interpleaders are in essence declaratory relief actions. What you're trying to do by the declaratory relief is to prevent the onslaught of litigation that's going to entail if in fact everybody starts fighting over this money. And I think that was Mr. Lopez's intent, which was to say, okay, we try to negotiate, we try to come up with a bona fide good settlement of this number because we have these competing interests and there isn't enough money to pay the full amount. I'll go to declaratory relief, and the stamp that I had that said I'll only keep 1/3 either is going to get litigated and then the judge will do whatever he needs to do. The key is, though, that Lopez kept the full amount in the trust account where he couldn't get at it. So he's never denied that the money's owed. It's just a question of how much can you pay out of a limited source that doesn't cover all of the particular liens and items that are there. And it's in a case where you have less money in settlement than you have in liens and in medical expenses.
What's the law or the authority in the state of Nevada that in those type cases that don't produce enough settlement to or enough of funds to pay the liens, the lawyer, and the client? I mean,
and I think the law is exactly what similar to what Mr. Lopez did. I think the law states in that situation, absent a settlement among those parties, that what the attorney needs to do then is file an interpleader action, deposit the money with the court, and allow the court to referee between the competing interests as to who gets what out of that money.
Which, of course, your client didn't do either.
And I was going to ask that, too. Why didn't he?
Well, I think what he did is he had that stamp that he had put on to the lien because of the additional provision where the lawyer had to sign, and there was a question about him having to then pay attorney's fees if there was litigation over it. He put that stamp over, and what got litigated was the declaratory action. The whole time he did have the money. When the court determined, in fact, that that stamp was not good and he couldn't limit it to a third, then I think the court could have just simply at that point in time said, no, you have the money, we need to go ahead and do.
Why did he do that, though? Did he interfere with the contract? Did he breach a fiduciary duty? What?
No, quite frankly, I don't think any of those causes of action are allowed under the economic loss doctrine in any case. I think that
one I want to hear about. How do you get the economic loss doctrine wrapped around this?
I think because this is a purely contract case. I mean, even the Akram case describes that these type of assignments are contractual in nature. It's a contract case. The economic loss doctrine was invented in order to prevent these type of tort actions and contract actions. Dr. Correll is claiming solely under that contract that he has with the third party, with the patient, and there's questions about whether or not that addition that he tried to have Mr. Lopez sign, which Mr. Lopez did sign with the modification or the counteroffer of the 33 and a third. So all of the damages, everything that he has from this flows from contract. It does not flow from a tort action. And
so I think what you're asking us to do is to send it back to the district court, have the money deposited with the court, and then the court determine how much the client gets, the chiropractor gets, and the lawyer gets.
Right, except with the proviso that I think the case law indicates that the lawyer has a priority lien. So I think in some of these cases.
What authority are you citing for that?
There's a case in our brief, and I don't know if I have it right in front of me, but there's a case law that indicates that the lawyer is entitled to. Let's see if I can find it. I'm sorry, I don't have that right in front of you, but I can't find it on my rebuttal.
I have your briefs here. I may be able to find it while you continue your argument.
But there's case law that the attorneys are entitled to priority.
Full amount? 33 and a third, 40% if it's a trial?
I believe so.
50% if there's an appeal?
I believe so. I think that's what it says they're entitled to. Now, I think in this particular case, Mr. Lopez indicated that he was willing to, and had in the past, worked with Dr. Correll in negotiating these liens and negotiating things and attempting to work something out. I think the key, what Mr. Lopez was attempting to do, is try to get money in the pocket of his clients. And I think there was testimony also that Mr. Lopez was at 25%, not these higher rates. So I believe the economic loss doctrine absolutely applies. And I think, in fact, the respondents agreed because they didn't say anything that indicated they had any case law or anything that would disagree with that. Their only contention was that they had filed tort claims. Well, that's the purpose of the economic loss doctrine, is to prevent tort claims being filed in these purely commercial type of cases where there's no personal injury to Dr. Correll. No.
Did the trial judge find that there was torts committed?
He did. I think that was erroneous. I think, in fact, that under the economic loss doctrine, he should not have found that. What he should have found was that there was no tort actions available in this case, and preferably had said those counterclaims are not legitimate. They shouldn't stand. We're going to deal with the declaratory relief action, and then we'll deal with the money that's in there and figure out where it belongs and get the competing interests that have claims on this amount of money that's there, and go ahead and disperse it accordingly.
You don't dispute then that your client clearly violated the mandate, if you will, of the Akram case, which says if a conflict develops between a client's interest and the interests of a third party over funds in the attorney's possession, the attorney should deposit those funds in a trust account and request a court to direct the funds distribution?
No, I think he did do that. He did put the money into a trust account. He
and
then tried
the court to direct the funds?
Right. Well, I don't know if he did. He didn't exactly do that, but he did bring a declaratory relief action, which, again, like I said, I think there's federal law that indicates these are, in essence, similar actions, because when you're asking for declaratory relief, you're asking the same that you would an interpleader, the court to declare something and do something. In this case, he did keep the money separate. He didn't deny, in fact, that the money was owed. It was just a matter of how much was going to be paid out of that fund that was available.
I don't agree it's the amount that's in dispute. I think the question is the manner in which Mr. Lopez went about holding the funds and making what appear to be unilateral decisions with respect to distribution.
Well, and I think the Akron court does say hold it in a trust account, and I think that's what he did do. The difference is instead of an interpleader, he filed a declaratory relief action after trying to settle it and after looking for a good faith accord and satisfaction of their differences in these particular cases. But in any case, regardless, I think that the counterclaims are all tort-based. The damages are all tort-based, and I think those are clearly barred by the economic loss doctrine. The two issues that I think that are most important, at least regardless of those issues, I think each one of those cases has problems with the evidence that was presented, I think even on appeal. I don't think that there's enough evidence or any evidence submitted that will hold up for the elements of those tort claims, even if considering the fact that they are legitimate claims. I don't think that they proved what they needed to prove in each one of those type of situations in order to carry the day and find a legitimate finding against Mr. Lopez. None of the things that he did was misrepresentation. The claims were that the misrepresentations were based on the red stamp that he put there, and I don't think that that necessarily was a misrepresentation. What I do want to talk about in my last minute here is the punitive damages. I really think that the punitive damages in this particular case were not needed or not necessary. There was nothing that was done here other than Mr. Lopez having a group, an amount of money that he had to pay with a limited resource, keeping the money in a trust account, attempting to work a settlement when he couldn't get a settlement, taking the case to the court with a declaratory relief action. So I don't think anything he did was malicious. I don't think it was oppressive. I don't think there was any fraud involved. I don't think they can prove that there was any of those type of things. There was no unjust hardship to Dr. Corral. His contract's intact. The money that he is going to be able to get out of this is intact. The full amount was kept.
And I understand your point, but this is a bench trial, and the judge, as a trier of fact, made certain findings that would give rise to a claim for punitive damages. So how do we deal with the fact that we have to affirm if there's substantial evidence to support it?
I think the judge referred to in the end, in the transcript, that he felt that the punitive damages were a way of awarding attorney's fees to Dr. Corral. And so I think that's an improper way. Punitive damages are there to punish culpable conduct, and I don't think there is any culpable
conduct.
Well,
it's, I think, another issue on the attorney's fees. I mean, he could have awarded it under Rule 11 or 18010 on the bad faith provisions. So I'm a little surprised it would even be part of the punitive damage calculus there. But.
And, in fact, he didn't. That was considered later under a separate motion for attorney's fees, and he did do it, and he exercised his discretion and said no, that he would not, that he thought that would be too punitive to award attorney's fees. So I think my time.
You want to reserve the rest of your time? You have 3 minutes and five seconds.
Yes.
Chief, and that maybe we'll give you enough time to make up for my next question. I don't want to take away from your time.
Thank you.
I assume, because your brief says so, and the essence of your argument is that twofold. Number one, you believe the district court erred when he found the fiduciary duty, correct?
Absolutely.
And you believe that the matter of a fiduciary duty in this circumstance has not been established by the state of Nevada?
I don't believe that it has. I don't think in this situation, in this context. I mean, there are fiduciary situations, but what you have here is a fiduciary being created out of a third party contracting with Dr. Corral to somehow create a fiduciary obligation for Mr. Lopez that he has never agreed to, hasn't been compensated for, hasn't anything in or received any kind of remuneration for. The classic fiduciary obligation relationships are set out in the case law, and they're trustee and stockholders and presidents of companies. So this is not that situation. Mr. Lopez is not even a party to this contract. And I think the court, if they create for attorneys with a medical lien a fiduciary obligation that lawyer then has to carry out, I think there are going to be a lot of plaintiffs' lawyers in the world who are going to say, I am not touching a case that has a medical lien because I've just opened myself up to a massive amount of claims in tort in violations of fiduciary duties. I don't know what, I mean, I would be very hesitant if I was an attorney to want to tie into something like that. And I think that interferes, in fact, I think that interferes completely with the attorney-client relationship, because if the doctor is able to have a lien signed that creates a fiduciary obligation from the attorney to the doctor, what does that do to the relationship between the attorney and the client, which is sacrosanct, and his obligation to look out for that client?
Thank you. Thank I'll you. Give you your 3 minutes when you
okay. Thank for you.
Your rebuttal.
I appreciate Spencer, it.
On behalf of Dr.
Justices, thank you very much.
Correll?
We're moving into fall. It's nice to see you all. There are a number of statements and a lot of activity in this case, and it seems to me that many times we start a case out with a very narrow set of facts. And by the time we get here, all of a sudden we've got a bag of hair and we're trying to pull one strand out and make it connect to the end. And it becomes a little bit difficult. What I'd like to go here is take you back to the very beginning of this action. There was a declaratory relief action filed on part of Mr. Lopez saying, hey, I want a declaration of what? I want a declaration that the language contained in my red stamp is valid and enforceable. That's what he wanted. Geez, Judge, please declare my red stamp valid and enforceable. And are you all familiar with the language of the red stamp?
Why don't you put it in the record so we have it.
To restate it.
Please do.
We just referred to it as a red stamp because on the assignment of benefits, commonly referred to a lien, after the patient and the doctor sign it, at some point later, it's sent to Mr. Lopez's office, and the instruction is to put the red stamp warning on it. So if we start out with a declaratory relief action that the red stamp is valid, we're now here talking about, gee whiz, I was trying to negotiate. It was an attempt to compromise. It was an accord and a satisfaction. It has ballooned into something that it never was. Here was a gentleman who said, I want to be a hero to my clients. I want to do a third, third, third split. I want to take a third for fees. I want to make sure my client gets a third, and whatever's left, I want to make sure the doctor gets. That should never be more than a third. That's what he testified to at trial. But what these patients received is they received care, they received health care, and Mr. Lopez says, I'm not interested in that. I want to make sure I get more business and my clients like me. That was his testimony. So this matter started with declaratory relief action, and if we look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law, it's very interesting. The statement from Judge Plaha is fairly short. Mr. Lopez requested a declaration from the court that his unilateral attempt to modify the existence of a contract between Dr. Corral and his patients by way of the red stamp was in some way binding on Dr. Corral. No authority was presented by Mr. Lopez to support this proposition, even though the court repeatedly requested supporting authority. This court finds there's no authority or merit to Mr. Lopez's assertion that he has a contractual right to unilaterally modify the existing contract. Further, there was no consideration provided to Dr. Corral. And it goes on. In regard to the complaint for declaratory relief from Mr. Lopez, the court finds there is no basis upon which the relief can be granted. The court finds that the claim of Mr. Lopez for declaratory relief is not premised upon law or fact, and that there's no justifiable basis in law or fact for filing or maintaining of the complaint for declaratory relief. What was going on in the declaratory relief action was, hey, geez, Judge, can I use the red stamp? It wasn't there was inadequate money to pay Dr. Corral. That never came up. We're hearing it here. There was some brief mention of it in the transcript at the time of trial. But Mr. Lopez also said at the time of trial, and it's cited in the briefs, and I asked him specifically, do you have all the money that Dr. Crowell claims to be owed to him? Yes, I do. You have all the money or the red stamp amount? I have all of the money. Not the red stamp amount. I have all of the money that he claims to be owed. So now all of a sudden we have, geez, we're hearing a new issue, and that is how do we go in and apportion the funds that have been recovered? Well, that's an issue that's coming here in Carson City, and that's not an issue we had in Reno. And it's not an issue that was set forth in the declaratory relief action. And it was not an issue that was set forth in the counterclaiming action. The declaratory relief action wasn't appealed. The finding that there was no justifiable basis in fact or law was never appealed.
What about the economic loss doctrine? Does it even come into play?
The economic loss doctrine is really a simple doctrine. If you have damages that are arising from contract breach, then you're limited to contract-type damages, the old Hadley versus Baxendale rule. There's no general damage award in this case. The economic loss doctrine is a red herring. It doesn't apply in this case at all.
He was owed $44,000, and that's what he got?
And that's what he got. There was no pain, suffering, emotional distress. There was nothing else that came up from it. And even if the economic loss doctrine did apply in some fashion, it doesn't apply where there's an intentional tort. And there are intentional torts supported by significant evidence in the record.
What about this breach of fiduciary duty? How do you view it in the state of Nevada?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's something we may have a resolution on after this case a little bit more. I've cited to the court the information in the case law as well as the statutory law on fiduciary duty. And if you'd like, I'd be happy to give the court the reference to that page.
Does the lien actually establish a fiduciary duty with the attorney as far as you're concerned?
I don't think it does. I don't think the lien itself creates a fiduciary duty. I believe the fiduciary duty comes when the attorney takes possession of property belonging to a third party, and it's a simple rule of ethics we've all lived with under the Supreme Court rules. Your duty arises when you have possession of money, your duty of safekeeping of property belonging to a third person.
What's the attorney entitled to, though, in that situation?
Well, you know, that's a great question here. And given the facts of this case, I can't tell you how I really would like to address that. What is the attorney entitled to here in that situation where we have this type of conduct? There is case law, and I think I can point it to, it's in my brief, and there was a section, I'll bring this to you.
Well, they had the one case involving John Muji. That was quite a few years ago on this issue, and some others that were referred to in here. But is the lawyer automatically entitled to the contingent fee off the top here in this situation?
Well, I think that may be somewhat fact-specific. And I think in many instances, attorneys do an incredible job of advocating for their clients, and they work their rear ends off, and they expend a lot of time and a lot of money and make a recovery, and maybe that recovery is not adequate to fully compensate everybody that wants to be fully compensated. But in certain situations, such as the one we have here, where this attorney recovered funds, and it was more than a year before he files the deck action, so he's sitting on funds. This isn't one of those situations where we jump right up and say, I got money, and there's a situation here, there's a dispute. That didn't happen here. So I think we look at the facts specific in this case, and we can take some reference to the second restatement of law governing attorneys, and it states, a lawyer engaging in clear and serious violation of the duty to a client, and I extend it here to a third party, Dr. Crow, a lawyer engaging in clear and serious violation of duty to a client may be required to forfeit some or all of the lawyer's compensation for the matter. Consideration relevant to the question of forfeiture includes the gravity and timing of the violation. We know here he had the money for a year before he came to court. To this day, Dr. Corral has not been paid for treatment he provided in 2006. Mr. Lopez testified that he has paid himself and did so within 3 to 4 days, reimbursed his costs and paid himself his fees. And even a year later, Dr. Corral hasn't been paid, and that's when we get the deck action.
What did the client get?
We have no idea what the client got. No evidence in the record on that at all. Number two, it's willfulness, the conduct of the attorney and the willfulness. Number three, its effects on the value of the lawyer's work for the client, any other threat of actual harm to the client, and the adequacy of other remedies. Never a declaratory relief action filed for the purpose, how do we apportion this? No interpleader of the fund. I've got all the money in my account. I'm the sole officer of the corporation. I'm the only person who has signing authority on this account. And it's in my account. And Mr. Lopez testified at trial, the purpose of the red stamp and the subsequent tenders of some of the checks for the red stamp amount were intended to preclude Dr. Corral from receiving any other benefit, any further benefit beyond this. So the conduct here, the claims here is, well, it was an attempt to negotiate. It was an accord and satisfaction. And Justice, as I ask you one question. We're told here repeatedly in the briefs that there was a dispute. What was the dispute? What was the dispute that Mr. Lopez had? Was there a good faith dispute? Dr. Corral committed malpractice. Dr. Corral overcharged. Dr. Corral didn't do this. No. What was the dispute? What was the good faith dispute? Was there ever a good faith dispute other than Mr. Lopez saying, I put my red stamp on it, and that's the law? There was never a good faith dispute about any issue in this case at all.
So the only resolution that the district court made in this case was a determination of validity or the enforcement of the red stamp.
No, the court did more than that. That's what the court made a determination on in the DEC action and in the counterclaim, which is probably part and parcel of the majority of the reason that we're here, and I'll be happy to address any of those issues if the court would like. But again, the whole dispute and the defense that's now being presented is that Mr. Lopez acted in good faith because, A, there's a dispute. But what was the dispute? Where was the dispute? The testimony has been, in the briefs, it is stated that the contract or the red stamp was an attempt to modify the contract. It was an attempt to negotiate. The tender was marked full and final as a counteroffer. It was a counteroffer. It was an attempt to negotiate. It was an attempt to obtain an accord and satisfaction. And that takes us back as a trigger on the accord and satisfaction, one of the key elements, and that is accord and satisfaction requires a bona fide dispute. It doesn't mean, hey, I don't like it, I'm not paying you. It means, hey, we have a legitimate dispute. Did you do the work? Did you do it properly? There's no dispute on those issues. Now, I want to go over to the issue on the attorney's fees. Mr. Vela said something I strongly disagree with. When the motion for attorney's fees was presented to the Judge Palaha, to the trial court, Mr. Vela said that the trial court properly exercised its discretion and denied the motion for attorney's fees. I've presented in our brief to the court that the issue of attorney's fees is not discretionary if there's a finding that the action was brought or maintained without good faith, meaning not based upon fact or warranted by existing law. Judge Palaha, if you've read the transcript, Judge Palaha went on page after page after page and said to Mr. Lopez, Mr. Lopez, what is your basis for this? What authority do you have? Do you have any case law? Do you have, why would we do this? And Mr. Lopez consistently stated, it's Hornbook law, Your Honor. Well, what was the basis? And it never came about. And that was how Judge Palaha came to this conclusion that it wasn't brought in good faith. It wasn't based upon existing law or fact. And when we go to that point, Your Honor, or Justices, excuse me, when we go to that point, we have two guidance, we have two mandates from the legislature of this state that require the imposition of attorney's fees.
But in a bench trial, if the judge says, look, I gave you $25,000 in punitive damages, and that really covers attorney's fees, should we set it aside as an appellate court if that's what the judge did? I mean, we were all on the district court bench, and sometimes we do things like that in bench trials.
Okay. I'm with you. I completely agree. Here's what we have. At the end of the transcript and at the end of the findings of fact, the judge said, Judge Palaha stated, if there's another basis upon which you can bring an award of attorney's fees or a motion for attorney's fees, do so, and don't do it on the basis of the lien. Okay? Here we go. Here goes the findings of fact in. There's a finding that it was not brought in good faith. It fit all the requirements, the mandates of 7085 and 180102B, I believe. It hit those mandates. Here's a motion for attorney's fees, and the judge says, I have imposed punitive damages, and therefore I'm not going to award attorney's fees. That's wonderful. But now he's in violation of state law, and that becomes a question of law. Is it discretionary? It wasn't discretionary at that point. I understand the conflict, because the judge says, geez, I really wanted to make this right for Dr. Corral, and I gave punitive damages. But he didn't say in the trial, and he didn't say in the findings of fact, I gave him punitive damages because I wanted to serve as attorney's fees. The mandate of the legislature on two different statutes is right on the point. We have a professional who lost money as a result of the conduct of Mr. Lopez. The conduct of Mr. Lopez was not brought in good faith. And I'd like to reserve my time.
Okay, you have a couple minutes.
Can I ask one other question?
I'll give you 2 minutes or about that.
On the alter ego, I'm kind of intrigued by this issue, and I'm going back through the findings while you both were speaking, and I'd like you both to address this. You don't need an alter ego finding to recover if it's recoveries in tort. You know, in this case, Judge Palaha found tort liability against Mr. Lopez individually and through his professional corporation. So is this really, that only really applies to contractual claims? Is that
I don't know that it's particularly necessary, but the issue here really is there's this corporation, Anthony Lopez and Associates, and it's engaging in the practice of law. But in reality, it can't because it can only act through an attorney. So there's a non-delegable duty, and there's also a non-delegable duty in the case law. As a matter of fact, the United States Supreme Court has stated in the context of Rule 11, it states, Rule 11 conveys a non-delegable duty upon the signing attorney to conduct his own independent analysis of the facts and law from which the basis, or which form the basis of the pleading or motion.
Well, when they answered the counterclaim, did they say there's no liability on behalf of the corporation?
I don't recall, Your Honor.
It's just Mr. Coulter. Again, I mean, we see this issue a lot, but my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, you both are experts on this, but in professional corporations, my understanding was the corporate veil does not shield you from tort liability, whether it's a medical corporation, a legal corporation, an accounting corporation, or whatever. If there's a tort, there's a tort, and it's automatically goes to the principals there. Now, contracts are different. If you have a contract for a lease or something like that, yes, the normal corporate principles apply. But if I'm wrong, please tell me, because I've been laboring under that assumption for years.
It's two of us, by the way, Justice.
I haven't labored on that assumption. I believe it to be accurate.
Okay.
I think that's an exact statement of the law.
I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal, and meanwhile, I'll give you 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
I think we are in agreement on one thing. We're all laboring under the same assumption.
Okay.
So the alter ego argument that was made is based on the fact that there was a lot of factors, especially in regard to the unity of interest that the court didn't go through, which was commingling of funds, undercapitalization, unauthorized diversion of funds, those type of things that the court never even looked at when they made this determination to pierce the corporate veil. In response to Mr. Coulter, who's a very able advocate, I would say that the dispute that existed was over a pot of money that didn't cover everybody, and that's common in plaintiffs' personal injury type cases. That was the dispute. How do we get pay everybody with this limited?
But if it were so common, we'd have a bunch of case law.
Right.
I haven't seen this.
Right.
I practice law in Clark County. I never had this situation happen.
And I think it would have been very simple to handle it this way. He asked, how did we get so complicated and get here today? The way we got so complicated and got here today was the filing of about 6 or 7 counterclaims that weren't necessary. The declaratory relief action, when the judge told, and the reason it wasn't appealed, because Mr. Lopez is accepting the judge's
determination. Well, Mr. Coulter's saying the declaratory relief action was to ask to declare the red stamp and the language restricting the medical recovery to 33% to be valid.
Correct.
And that was the gist of the not to distribute the money.
Right. And I think the basis of that claim was, look, I've tried to limit based on the second section where he had me signing to say I can only save 33 1/3%, which and so I may not have enough funds to pay your full lien. That's what he's trying to tell him. Now, whether he never put that stamp on there or not, that's true regardless. That's the situation. It doesn't matter whether he put a stamp and says, I may not be able to pay your full lien. That's what happens. And that was the point. And he tried, and for this year period he's talking about, he was trying to negotiate. He was trying to get with somebody who he had negotiated previously, who had been willing to deal with him and maneuver these things when the need was there for the clients, to make sure the clients got something out of this. And I think it's completely wrong to say that Mr. Lopez was doing this to enhance his reputation. He was doing it, as he said, in answer to the question, if you read the transcript, his reputation might be enhanced because he was fighting for his clients to make sure they got some money.
I don't think anybody would fault him for that, Mr. Bellis. It's just my concern, and I know hindsight's wonderful, but if he had a second cause of action beyond the red stamp as cause one, cause two,
right,
was an interpleader saying, hey, you know, we got this money divided up. I want a third. The provider shouldn't get more than a third, and the client gets the rest. Nothing wrong with that.
Right.
And then argue that to the court.
And I think perhaps that was what Mr. Lopez was hoping. If he's looking there, he saw that he had the money in trust. He held the entire amount, not just a little bit. And I think he thought once that stamp is decided, either I'm right or I'm wrong, then the money's going to have to be paid. The key, though, is the thing that the judge ordered, the $44,000 fully paid. That is not the amount. What he basically ended up ordering is Mr. Lopez to have to come out of pocket to pay, which I don't think the law is. I don't think there's independent obligation for the attorney then to have to cover the medical lien when there's not enough money to cover that lien, and that's the problem. That's why we wanted it remanded back so that they can sit and figure this out. I don't believe that there was any maliciousness in anything that Mr. Lopez was trying to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Coulter, 2 minutes.
Thank you. Today, Mr. Lopez would like to have this court send the matter back to trial court and make an apportionment of those cases where there may not have been an adequate amount of money to fully pay Dr. Corral. That was not an argument made at trial. That was not an issue at trial. It's an issue today to see if we can get this case remanded. It didn't happen. If, in fact, there was a good faith dispute, Justice Cherry, you had asked, how do you do it if you don't have enough money to pay everybody? We could look through the records, and I imagine we'd find in Clark County there was more than one occasion in which you filed an interpleader action, and you sued as a defendant in the interpleader action. The 42 doctors who handle the matter and are owed $400,000, and there's only $100,000 available. It's an interpleader action. That never happened. There was never a dispute about the amount owed until we got here.
What about the amount of $44,000 versus what was actually owed? Do you know what
that is? The amount actually owed.
That's what he proved at trial.
That's what he proved at trial. That's the amount actually owed. There was, and it's in the transcript, there's some issue about, well, we didn't actually get any money for this person. That's still in litigation. During the course of trial, we withdrew our claims as it pertained to those individuals that were in trial. We said, if you haven't recovered any funds, you don't owe us any money because you've never taken possession of money that would
right.
come that would come or be the subject of the assignment of benefits. Nothing further.
Any other questions, Justice Gibbons, Justice Sennett? Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. They're very, very interesting arguments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This case will stand submitted. We'll just be at ease until